like a Hellcat.
Hello and welcome to the seventh installment of my lecture series on John Gardner's On Moral Fiction. My name is Matthew McGevna, host of The Ink Drop, which could be found on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. I've been uploading some of my podcast episodes to YouTube. It's a little bit of a painstaking process. I don't have an editorial assistant or anybody to do it, so trying to squeeze it in between writing the content for the show, recording content, editing and all that. But I do have a YouTube presence. I do have a YouTube channel. And I'm going to be uploading this series as well to the YouTube channel if you want to check it out there. I've been dissecting Gardner's, if you've been under a rock, I've been dissecting Gardner's nonfiction book chapter by chapter. And the episode I'm recording now, the one you're listening to, is the second episode of part two of the book, which is titled Principles of Art and Criticism. Part one of the book was called Premises on Art and Morality. And of course, as always, I say this every week, if you're hearing this for the first time, feel free to stop listening, go back to the previous six episodes, so you can see how Gardner kind of lays the groundwork and builds his way up in his analysis of moral fiction, which I really think is kind of, I'm doing this because I feel that our moral fiction is kind of a forgotten about but really important text for our age. As we enter into it. And in this chapter that we're getting into, Gardner turns his attention to the role and the responsibility of critics. And what is moral criticism? He talks a bit about moral fiction last week, and now we're going to look at moral criticism. Now, he starts out with an interesting premise, and one that's worth thinking about for a bit, right? Because bear in mind, this book was published in the late 1970s. I've said that multiple times, right? And as anyone, you know, that's around my age, so anyone who's been around that long knows that things have really changed quite a bit. This book came out way before the internet was available, way before blogs, way before social media was a thing that created something called democratization, right? We live now in an age of democratization, a real do-it-yourself kind of culture. So when Gardner gets into it, he touches in the early paragraphs on what we're currently living, which is the democratization of everything, including criticism. Right? So he opens the chapter by saying it's a little absurd, as the cartoonist David Levine has sometimes mentioned, that criticism should be the business of specialists. It ought not to require years of education for a man to pronounce judgment on a blank canvas presented as a finished work of art, or knowledge of all music from Bach to Robert Helps, for a man to assess the aesthetic significance of blowing up a grand piano. Right? So, yeah, it does seem intuitive, right, this time that we're living in, for people who enjoy reading fiction but work as corrections officers or math teachers or insurance agents, to be able to weigh in on whether or not a particular work of fiction is worth our time. One should not require a degree to be able to do that. And the time we live in now does seem to mirror that intuition. Okay. The idea that we need to rely on experts to tell us what to read and what not to read seems, you know, well, kind of silly on its face. But that was the reality of the literary world up until about 5 minutes ago, right? And to be fair, it kind of still is when you think about it. What do I mean by that? Well, any writer will probably tell you they would much rather Michiko Kakutani come out of retirement, right, at the New York Times and review their debut novel than 100 New York City bus drivers posting their review on Amazon or Goodreads. There are still gatekeepers, and there are still legacy media installations that earn a writer a lot more credibility. Not to mention, by and large, the legacy media critics like Kakutani will probably not bring into the evaluation of the novel all of their personal and political peeves in an effort to hall monitor the art world, right? Which is what you do get very often with more of the amateur scope. That's what you have happening in certain corners of Goodreads, and to a lesser extent, Amazon. Critics, in scare quotes, right, either disguised as social activists or social activists disguised as critics, will review a work of fiction through a particular lens nowadays, and then they'll pin their evaluation on the level to which it gives voice to the voiceless, or gives offense, or promotes stereotypes, or does harm, or uplifts a particular social movement or issue. And that's a relatively new landmine that many authors find themselves having to navigate when it comes to how we interact with the critic. But Gardner's right. Why do we put more stake in experts, right, reviewing a book for the New York Times, when we would probably be better encouraged by a small army of enthusiastic readers who approach the book with a pure and open heart? In Gardner's time, he didn't really have that option, right? The books you knew about because The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Rolling Stone, the LA Review of Books told you about them. And by and large, readers trusted their judgment. Why? Well, let's look at that somewhat, according to what Gardner says, right? Now, there is value in having a person who reads for a living, who has read all manner of fiction throughout the course of their day. They have a distinct advantage over the rest of us in determining which novels should we rush out to read and which we can safely ignore, right? Which novels teach us how to live and which novels are just fashionable propaganda. As Gardner says, which is more relevant and morally beneficial for the deep-seated diseases of the age, end quote, right? Now, that's an interesting phrase, the deep-seated disease of the age. Because it has to do with the conflicts of human life a writer chooses to build as a way for our characters to see a moral way out. Does that make sense? So, in The Stranger, for example, the deep-seated disease was human dishonesty. I think we can say that with some relative degree of safety. Poor Camus scholars come for my head. Right. The Monsignor at the prison is shaking Mersault and telling him, right, commanding him to believe in Christ as Redeemer. And Mersault's having none of it. Right. To do so would make an honest man dishonest. Right. And dishonesty is absolutely a deep-seated disease of the age. Same with cruelty, bigotry, and distrust, which was a deep-seated disease of Victor Hugo's age when he sat down to write La Notre Dame de Paris. You like the way I said that, right? I practiced that. the disconnect also between war and the need for human contact is a deep-seated disease of just about any age, but it's captured brilliantly in Inman, right? The main character of Charles Frazier's Odyssean novel, Cold Mountain. The conflicts that were built to deliver these morally beneficial novels that I just listed were pretty different, right? A murder trial, as is the case with The Stranger, a disabled bell ringer trying to stand up for himself against a cruel and a genocidal religious leader, as with La Notre Dame de Paris, and an American Civil War soldier who basically goes AWOL, right, and is being hunted by the Home Guard in Cold Mountain. Now, these aren't the best examples because these are all instances where the critics got it right, in my estimation. All three of these novels were critically acclaimed. Cold Mountain is a bit too young still to determine if that ultimate critic, who goes by the name of Time, will be kind to it. But the other two are part of our literary canon. Now, the professional critic has this distinct advantage of telling us what books are leading the way properly, but that isn't what's happening now. It wasn't happening in Gardner's day either, right? Instead, they simplified their jobs to pay more attention to technical prowess, a thing you might hear called timeliness, right? This book is very timely. Or a book that adds beautiful window dressing to some new philosophy or another that's floating around. Some new trend. And Gardner says in this chapter, there are some basic things that most critics would probably agree should be present in a work of fiction. Number one, is it aesthetically interesting? Has the writer introduced the story in a new or fresh or interesting way, whether that's through point of view or a narrator or a framework that breathes some life into how the story is told? Number two, is it technically accomplished? Does the structure of sentences, plot, character development work in tandem to create a kind of seamless world? So does it have technical acumen? And then third, and maybe the most important for Gardner, is it intellectually massive? What does that mean? Does it assert what is true about human experience? Does it lead us out of the darkness? Is it intellectually massive? Now, the problem with all this is that it's subject to the whims of the critic, right? Many critics will find the work of Jonathan Franzen to be all three of those, while others will find him completely unreadable. Raising my hand slowly. Gardner breaks down 2 to 3 major movements of criticism, starting with the new critics, who tended to analyze fiction as though it was written in a bubble, independent of the time periods, the culture, the socioeconomic background, the zeitgeist, right, of the writer's own biographical framework, right? So even the writer's own biography, you would absent from your evaluation. Now, this was done in answer to what was at the time the prevailing criticism of the 19th century, which focused more on the writer and his life, right, his biography, and then infuse that information into evaluation of the artwork. Now, that has some value, but that doesn't tell the whole story, right? Nor, though, does completely ignoring the writer's life, right, and going for a direct treatment of the book itself, absent of the influences that helped to shape it in the first place. And this is how we get to criticism that focuses so much on the tools the writer uses, the clever tricks the writer employs, the turns of phrase, the freshness of the metaphors. But we get nothing else but the book's technical acumen. Sorry, it falls short, right? When we focus so much just on the tools, because we can't, we're deliberately excluding the biography, we're deliberately excluding the influences that might have been brought to bear upon the work of literature, the work of art, and we're just focusing then on the techniques, right? Those card tricks. And it ushered in another approach to criticism, right, that also can't really be considered criticism as much as analysis. As a reaction to new critics and their, you know, sort of objective, cold evaluation of the writer's skill, his tools, his tricks, other approaches emerged that tried to basically cram a work of fiction into some socio-political lens, right? So therefore you had Marxist criticism, feminist criticism, racialism, Freudian criticism, so forth. The problem with all these forms of approach is that it attempts to make a cold science out of what is really an emotional endeavor, right? And that's what Gardner's kind of getting at in this chapter. Right? The fact is, when we read fiction, we expect to have an emotional reaction to it, right? We expect the writer to have written it from an emotional place. So then what approach should critics take? It seems like I've kind of poo-pooed all of them, right? Or Gardner has, I should say, right? Gardner tries to clarify that a little bit. He says, what criticism ought to be is the business of asking, as I.A. Richards phrased the question 50 years ago, what gives the experience of reading a certain poem its value? How is this experience better than another? So here's kind of an answer to what he thinks we should be looking at when we're looking at criticism, or when we're even when we're creating criticism, right? When we're analyzing a work. How is this experience better than another? Why prefer this picture to that? In which ways should we listen to music so as to receive the most valuable moments? Why is one opinion about works of art not as good as another? What is a picture? A poem? A piece of music? How can experiences be compared? What is value? A moment's thought shows that usefulness of these questions is precisely that the critic thinking about different works of art can never answer them in the same way twice. Art does the same things, age after age, but because art deals with impressions, feelings, and because it will not submit to the petty demands of intellect, it is forever shifting ground, changing its means, sneaking up from behind. James Joyce, working in what may fairly be described as an innocent age, makes heavy use of symbolism, knowing the reader will catch it only subliminally, so that it will deepen rather than intellectualize his fiction. Today, when we read Dubliners, though it's less true, I think, of the later books, the symbols stand out like wounds. That is, what was subtle and innovative in Dubliners is now obvious. So today, the serious writer must subvert his reader's intelligence, getting to what matters some other way. It's of course true that we do find symbols in the work of John Hawkes, John Bach, Tom Pynchon, William Gass, or Douglas Wolff. But Hawkes' symbols slip and slide, transmogrify, turn inside out. Barth's symbols are as open as jokes. Pynchon's symbols are platonic inexpressibles. Mythic and mystical summaries of everything, not pegs on which to hang argument, but instead the innumerable disguises which mask what can only be described as the central mystery. Now, that's interesting because we're talking about criticism that attempts to look not just at the means of the writer's work, but to what ends it serves, right? Which is what he's been talking about the entire book. Both cannot be ignored, right? To ignore one mutilates the experience of reading and does the reader a disservice. So, okay, the new critics mutilated the experience by ignoring what the work of fiction says, affirms about life, or promulgates, and decided to focus only on how the book works as a self-contained organic body doing whatever it is that it's doing. But this approach leaves out the principal purpose of all art, which is affirmation, celebration, right? They ignore the questions about how to live to accentuate the beauty, right? So they abandon one to accentuate the beauty. So we go from beauty is truth and truth is relative? Okay. Well, where does that get us as a society, right? So what we have here in this chapter is a conversation when we look at criticism between a novel's technical attributes and the ends that it accomplishes. Those two things. This isn't to say that critics can't pay attention to a work's techniques, and there's nothing wrong with calling out writers with promise because of the way that they construct language or the way they've constructed a story or a new and fresh innovative way in which they unravel the plot, but the conversation can't end there. A moral critic, a critic who's looking at the wall, right, we talked about, the artist has constructed between order and chaos, has to concern himself not only with technique, but with how that technique was used to manifest something of an end, right? A direction toward what is good, what is true, and then ultimately what is beautiful. In some ways, because it's true, right? Okay, so what are those words? Good, true, beauty. Those words are not concrete objects, right? Those words are abstractions, right? They're values that can be recognized in works of art. And they're not relative values, but what we would call, what Gardner calls relative absolutes. That's an interesting phrase, right? Relative absolutes. Now, what does that mean? Relative absolutes. Huh. Well, we can know that absolutes can change depending on the framing. So, good health is an absolute, but it's also relative at the same time, right? An 80-year-old is in relative good health, considering his age. But health is still an absolute standard we can recognize, even though it might have variations or degrees. so we can understand when we encounter someone who is in bad health and what that means, right? And that's kind of the purpose of that relative absolute. Gardner says in the chapter, morality then describes actions or preparations for action, psychological actions. And since the possible number of actions in the universe is unlimited, as is the number of possible situations from which actions may proceed and take their tone, morality is infinitely complex, too complex to be knowable, and far too complex to be reduced to any code, which is why it is suitable matter for fiction, which deals in understanding, not knowledge. This does not mean that morality is out of our reach, but only that it is beyond the strictly analytical process which leads to knowing, right? I like that phrase. Fiction deals in understanding, not knowledge. Now, that's interesting. Because the difference is in the finality of knowledge versus the process of understanding, right? That's the difference between knowledge and understanding. Knowledge is a destination, no? Understanding is a process. And this applies to both the writer and the reader, really. Both are engaged in the process of understanding the dynamics of human interaction. And this is why understanding versus knowledge, or as opposed to knowledge, is better, more useful. Because we know how understanding can be somewhat subjective. And this is the value of living in a pluralistic society as we do. The idea that I can have an opinion which is different from another person's opinion so long as I don't violate another person's rights, right? Now, the challenge, the problem of pluralism, not that any sane person would want to do away with pluralism, but the challenge with living with it is that it seems to necessarily squash any notion of a universal morality or a shared value system, right? But this doesn't have to be the case, and Gardner gives an example, a really good example of child rearing in this chapter, right? He really changes up the track, and he talks about child rearing. Now, we all recognize that there are multiple approaches to raising children properly, right? And we can agree that, we all can kind of agree that subjecting children to abuse or violence or neglect or communicating that we don't care about the child in some fashion can have long-term consequences, serious consequences when the child grows up. Right, okay. So we can be divided, though, on how we should raise our children, for example, Jewish or Christian or non-denominational, atheist, a free-range, a do-what-you-want approach, or a helicopter approach. We can argue all day bitterly about that stuff, but we can be united in our understanding of the broad ways not to raise a child, right? Abusing them in some fashion, mistreating them, right? That's a shared morality that fiction will sometimes seek to understand, right? What are the ideal patterns of behavior when it comes to parenting? What are the ideal patterns of behavior for a soldier who has witnessed the slaughter of warfare and no longer wants a part in it, right? These ideal patterns we seek in fiction is the writer seeking out the good, capital G, right? For the critic, how did the writer slouch toward the good in their work of art? Meaning, how did the writer stab at some universal notion of good that we can all agree on despite our methodologies for getting there? Now, does that make sense? Fiction writers are less concerned with truth, capital T, truth, right? But there is this matter of truthful fiction, right? That is, fiction that accurately depicts the world we live in or the world we wish to learn about, right? So, as I read this chapter, I thought about Junot Diaz's brilliant novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, right? Thinking about Junot Diaz. And he draws an absolutely incredible well of truth about the Dominican Republic, right? Diaz depicts the Dominican Republic we hardly need to visit, right, after reading this because it's so drawn so vividly. And critics are right to praise this fact, right, despite the fact that truth is really a secondary concern of fiction, according to Gardner, right? In actuality, truth becomes a bigger problem for fiction in its absence, right? You notice it when it's not there. way more than you notice when it's there, right? When it's there, it's like water for a fish, right? When a writer drafts a completely unrealistic battle scene, right? Or places palm trees in the middle of Syracuse, New York, right? We notice those things, right? One of the most damning condemnations of Jeanine Cummins' novel American Dirt, right, for example, which just was a big controversy a year or two ago, is that her protagonist, one example that was brought up brilliantly, her protagonist looks with surprise at the concept of an ice skating rink in Mexico City, which is something that any natural-born Mexican wouldn't be surprised by, right? Also, there's a scene where the protagonist mocks the antagonist of the story for having the nickname of, like, a famous Mexican screech owl. But a natural-born Mexican would have understood the dangerous folklore and the mythical qualities of this particular species of owl, right? And so the description of the antagonist, who is a murderous cartel boss, in this instance being compared to an owl, was fitting, not infantilizing, not silly. So these were examples in that book where the absence of truth had the potential to sink fiction, but the presence of truth is not enough to elevate it, right? Does that compute? So the presence of truth is not enough, but the absence of truth becomes like an open wound, right? The best we can do, really, when it comes to truth is, well, that which does not feel like lying. Is that a way to think about it? And therefore resonates from within the soul of the writer, right? And is passed on to the reader so that it reads along the lines of authenticity, right? As for beauty, capital B beauty, Gardner says it's best described by Edgar Allan Poe. And so he quotes from Edgar Allan Poe about beauty. When indeed, Edgar Allan Poe said, men speak of beauty, they mean precisely not a quality, as is supposed, but an effect. They refer, in short, just to that intense and pure elevation of soul, not of intellect or of the heart, which is experienced in consequence of contemplating the beautiful. Right? So Gardner kind of throws in with Poe here and his definition of beauty, all writers aspire to capture. Beauty is the truth of feeling, right? The soul, right? It is feeling's version of truth. It is the emotion's version of truth, which we just talked about truth, right? Okay, that we can wrap our heads around. The way truth creates a trustworthy bond with the reader, right? Because it reads as authenticity, as a world we're comfortable inhabiting. Beauty serves the same function for the emotions, right? When we read a work of fiction that lacks a resonating vibrance of emotions, we imagine even the author must have felt something that was off, right? If not, the author, the writer, has a deficit sense of beauty, right? And needs to think about the infrastructure of his work. So there's goodness, there's truth, there's beauty, the three main concerns that all fiction writers should grapple with, and therefore all critics should evaluate and call to attention, right? Because remember, this chapter is really focusing on the critics. Are the critics analyzing the right moves of the writer, right? I'll leave you with Gardner's final words on this, right, when he talks about true criticism and the role of true criticism. He says, True criticism is, at least some of the time, morally judgmental. Huh. Now, what does he mean by that, right? I do not mean that to be a proper critic, one must bray like an ass or apply the same standards to The Odyssey and Stephen Becker's The Chinese Bandit. I mean only that when a novel or poem, a film or play, achieves some noble end, the critic should not hesitate to mention the fact and comment, insofar as possible, on how the effect is achieved. And when, as much more commonly happens, a literary work cheats or lies or achieves its right or wrong ends unfairly or celebrates what ought to be scorned or mocks what should be praised, the critic should say what has gone wrong and should point out why. Right? So the challenge, of course, is that this type of critical analysis is difficult to do, right? Plainly put, right? It's much easier to focus on the technique of a writer, right? To look at what a writer is doing, to break down his point of view shifts, to pluck out the one or two words that she chose to use above all her other options and hold it up to the public as innovation or as genius. But ignoring the goodness, the beauty, the truth by withholding judgment, which is the principal job of a critic, really, is tantamount to treating art as a plaything, right? Something that can be replicated with practice, something you can imitate, something that has trap doors and false floors, and it isn't. It still is civilization's best attempt to ascertain what values we must embrace and what we must reject. It is still that, right? Gardner says, it is precisely... And he ends the chapter with this. It is precisely because art affirms values that it is important. The trouble with our present criticism is that criticism is, for the most part, not important. It treats the only true magic in the world as though it were done with wires. Right? Now, this is especially important in our day because the internet, our do-it-yourself culture, has turned many people into actually influential critics within their own circles. Go ahead and read some book reviews from some of the top bloggers on the internet and ask yourself that question as you move forward. Are they withholding judgment about the good, the true, the beautiful? And if so, then think about how this can be combated a little bit. Maybe when you leave your own reviews, you know, as a writer, right? We'll leave that for now. Our next chapter focuses on the artist as critic. So now the writer has a responsibility to be a critic, him or herself, as well in this mix. So the next chapter looks at the artist as critic. How does the artist function as a critic, a determinant of what is moral fiction in their own right, in their own day-to-day interactions and communications with the art world, right? So that's what we're going to look at in the next chapter. As always, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy this lecture. I hope you're enjoying this series. Stay tuned next week for that 8th installment. We're almost finished, actually. You've been listening to The Ink Drop. My name is Matthew McGebna. Be sure to give me a review on Apple Podcasts or leave a mark on Spotify. And you take care.